welcome back. Welcome back to the Political Cesspool, everyone. I'm your host, James Edwards, alongside Eddie the Bombardier Miller tonight, as we have a very renowned guest joining us here in the Political Cesspool this evening. His name is Mark Weber, and since 1995, Mark has been director of the Institute for Historical Review, a prominent independent think tank and research and publishing center based in Southern California. Over the years, he's appeared as a guest on countless radio talk shows, for example, on the Barry Farber and Bob Grant shows in New York and with Bill Handel in Los Angeles. He's also made numerous television appearances, including as a guest on the Hannity and Combs show, as well as Montel Williams and on CBS's 60 Minutes. He's conducted numerous interviews with television, radio, and print journalists from across the United States and from Britain, Germany, Sweden, Lebanon, Iran, South Africa, and other countries. Weber studied at the University of Illinois in Chicago, the University of Munich in Germany, and Portland State University, from where he received a bachelor's degree in history with high honors. He did graduate work in history at Indiana University at Bloomington, where he served as a history instructor and received a master's degree in European history. In 1988, he testified for 5 days in the Toronto District Court and was recognized as an expert witness on the quote-unquote final solution and the Holocaust issue. He has worked full-time for Institute of Historical Review since January of 1991 and for 9 years was editor of the IHR's Journal of Historical Review, a very, very impressive resume. Mark Weber, thank you for being our guest this evening in the Political Cesspool.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Edwards. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show. You've been very effective over the years, and it's a really great thing to be on your show today.
Well, it's an honor that a man like you is even aware of our work, and we're proud of it ourselves, but kind of being the young pups in the movement, we've been around for a couple of years, but certainly made some headway, and I am honored that you've that you know about it, and it's been far too long that we didn't have you on this program, and I'm glad we can make amends to that tonight. And before we dive into the discussion of a very controversial topic this evening, it should be noted that the Institute for Historical Review is certainly not a one-trick pony that deals solely with history pertaining to World War II. I was having the opportunity to browse through your website extensively today in preparation for this interview, and you guys have a wonderful website that talks about historical events, factual information on historical events from a variety of different topics. I saw an interesting article today on Jamestown, which was a timely piece. So tell us a little more about the mission of the IHR.
Well, for a lot of people, history was a dull subject in school, but we try to make it relevant. We try to deal with historical issues as they relate to things happening now, because without an understanding of the background of anything, it's just impossible to really know what's going on. And that's particularly true in America today. We face just unprecedented challenges in our country, and without a proper diagnosis of the problem, we're not going to be able to overcome the difficulties that we have. We try to talk about historical issues as they relate to the trends of the time that we live in now, and we deal a lot with the background about the Middle East conflict, for example, because the continuing conflict there has gotten our country involved, of course, in a way that most Americans would have never imagined. We deal with the Second World War because of the tremendous impact that war has had on shaping the world we live in today and the dominant ideology of our times. But we deal with other issues as well, of course, and with American history. And that's what our goal and our mission is. And as you say, the IHR website covers a lot of these issues and tries to tie them into events that are in the news every day.
And we'll mention this again before the end of the interview, of course, but that website, folks, is IHR.org. And, Mark, you know, it's very important. People might say, well, whether or not this historical event actually occurred or didn't occur, how does it affect me today? Politically correct rewrites of history is very detrimental to our future, and why is that so?
Well, how we understand history is really how we understand ourselves. History is really two things. I mean, one level, it's an academic discipline, but it's also a very, very important part of our cultural life, of our social life, and how we define ourselves. We have a lot on our website, and we've dealt a lot over the years with, for example, the tremendous role that the Holocaust story plays in our society. This is emphasized in our country today, and it plays almost a religious role in our society.
Yes.
It's used to form for millions of Americans, our understanding of history, and we're supposed to draw certain lessons from our understanding of the Holocaust story. But this isn't an accident. It's not something that just arose spontaneously. It arose out of a very systematic effort to put the fate of one particular people front and center in our consciousness for very specific reasons. Because history, just like how we view current events and so forth, is carried out by people with an agenda who have interests of their own. And those interests are oftentimes not the same as our interests. Once they understand that, then it's possible to understand why we're being told this and what's behind it and what's intended.
And I want to talk, obviously, about that issue tonight. But before we get into that, I want to ask a couple of foundation questions before we get into that, because obviously the reason why the Holocaust story plays such a big role in the American consciousness today is due in part to a domino effect that began quite some time ago. And, you know, as we just said, it would be criminal to have an opportunity to interview Mark Weber and not broach the Zionist question, the question of whether or not there is a disproportionate amount of Jewish influence over American governmental affairs and over our media in general. So the million-dollar question is, do Zionist Jews have too much power in America?
Well, if you support the agenda of Israel and organized Jewry in the United States, you would say no, they don't have enough power. But for just about everyone else in America, it's obvious that a group that makes up something like 1, 2, 3% of the population, to have the indisputably great grip that it does on our media, on our cultural life, on our academic life, and so forth, is wildly disproportionate. And any number of even Jewish academics and scholars and other people have acknowledged that. Now, it's something we don't acknowledge very openly, because the power is so great and so intimidating that people are afraid even to acknowledge this, the power and its impact, much less to say, well, what are the consequences of this power and this influence in our society? But fortunately, there's much more awareness just in the past year across the United States and around the world about the tremendous and disproportionate power that organized Jewry or Jewish Zionist power has in our society. Jimmy Carter has belatedly, but nonetheless courageously, I think, talked about this on a number of occasions, and most notably in this new book he's written called Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid, in which he forthrightly notes that the tremendous intimidating power of this lobby is a large reason why Americans get a very skewed view of the Middle East and why our politicians are able to push policies in the Middle East that are contrary not only to the interest of the American people, but the interest of world peace and humanity.
Well, you know, I appreciate your answer very much. And obviously, for those with much sense of what's going on in this country, what you said is an irrefutable fact. But to even ask that question, for me to even ask you whether or not Jews have too much control in America and objectively wonder whether or not that's a good or a bad thing for our people will elicit charges of anti-Semitism and neo-Nazism against us. Why aren't American citizens allowed in our own country to have a frank and honest discussion about this issue without fear of reprisal?
Well, to throw it back to you, that's the $64,000 question, million-dollar question. Yes, I mean, it's because this power is based on such a level of distortion, of deceit, that the people who push this agenda and push this are always afraid that the jig will be up, that people will understand what is happening. That's why organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and organizations like the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which are pillars of the Jewish Zionist establishment in this country, are alarmed about the Internet because they can't control it. Due to the Internet and due to online broadcasts and so forth, people have access now to information and data that was just not available years ago. Just one example of that. A year ago, almost exactly a year ago, two important professors, Professors Stephen Walt and John Mersheimer,
yes,
issued their renowned paper on the Israel lobby. Now, that paper was originally going to be published in The Atlantic, a prominent scholarly or semi-scholarly magazine here in the United States. And after a lot of back and forth, it was rejected, and it appeared instead in the London Review of Books. But within an hour, within hours after the appearance of that article on the website of the London Review of Books and then on the Harvard University website, it was all over the world. Literally, everywhere around the world, people were commenting and passing this important item around. And that is the tremendous power of the Internet. If that article had 20 years ago appeared just in the London Review of Books, it would have had very little echo, very little impact here in the United States or much of any place. But the consequence of the Internet has been to give a forum to this piece and to much else that never would have been known before. And that's all to the good.
No, it absolutely is to the good. Freedom of speech and a healthy exchange of ideas in a candid debate can never be harmful. But, you know, I am a pretty level-headed guy, I think. I mean, most of my detractors wouldn't say that. But I try to look at both sides of the issue. And I'm telling you, Mark, I can't find, as an American citizen who is concerned about nationalism and is concerned about us behaving as a sovereign republic in the way our founding fathers originally intended this country to act, I can't see any positive light that comes from this disproportionate amount of Zionist control over our country. And we've obviously ceased behaving like a sovereign republic, and we have embarked on this road of imperialism. We've balked at George Washington and labeled him a racist. And is it because of America's one-sided support of Israel and our entanglement with Zionism that America has become so hated by the rest of the world, or is it just that we're the only righteous?
I think that's unquestionable, and I'm impressed again about how you articulate this and how you put this. I mean, Americans overwhelmingly want to feel good about our country. And I mean, all of us love our country. We want the best for our country. And it's a very difficult thing to acknowledge that as a consequence of our policies, America is more distrusted, more hated, more disliked than ever before. And I think that there's no question but that this is a direct and obvious consequence of this bizarre one-sided alliance we have with Israel. To align ourselves with a country as shaky and as dangerous as Israel is cannot help but be bad for the American people. We're told over and over, though, that we have a duty. It's absolutely our duty to support Israel and its policies that make a mockery of all the principles that we claim to uphold and support as Americans, and it's completely inconsistent with our history as a nation. Now, all this is really obvious. You know, you can tell, it's been pointed out in many times in court trials, for example, the guilty party is the one that wants to suppress information. The people who are the bad guys are the ones that don't want you to know things. The good guy in a trial is the one that's eager to have all the information put on the table in the hope and in the belief that this will exonerate him, this will support his case. In our society, it's obvious that organized Jewry, that the Zionist Jewish power, as I put it, is eager and has this long, consistent record of trying to suppress information,
yes,
trying to keep people from knowing the facts about the Middle East, about World War II, and about every other part of history that deals that touches on their interests.
Well, and that's a perfect segue into my next question. I'm going to do my best to maintain my composure when I ask you this, because this is one of the things that, to me, is one of the most disgusting abuses of power in the world. And I'm going to ask you that after I make this statement about what you just said with regards to why America is hated in the world. You know, America wasn't always hated. When we behaved as a constitutional republic, we were not hated amongst our neighbors throughout the world. And, you know, the argument that they would want us to believe in this day and age is that America and Israel are the only righteous nations and everyone else is just wicked.
Yeah.
And that's apocryphal. But it seems as though, to get to my question, it seems as though freedom of speech doesn't apply when one wishes to objectively question Zionist influence over our foreign policy.
Well, there's just no question of that, because those who do speak out about it are punished. And Jimmy Carter is completely right when he said people are intimidated. They're afraid. Because there's very, very harmful consequences for those to speak out. One of the best books on that subject is by former U.S. Congressman Paul Findlay, who wrote a book, They Dare to Speak Out, in which he laid out in great detail, from his own experience and from the experience of others, how political leaders and other people are just, their careers are destroyed if they dare to speak out on these issues. And it's interesting also, because in the case of Paul Findlay and many others, they didn't start out feeling strongly about this. They said, well, I think we should be even-handed, we should consider this, and so forth, and were astonished at the vehemence and the fury of groups like the ADL and the Simon Wiesenthal Center responding in the way they do. They regard, groups like that regard this not as a discussion about different issues, but as a war, as a battle. And they're intending to win, and they'll do anything they feel necessary and required to win.
Absolutely, and it's not just the slander and libel and the fear of losing your job. You know, I can question my government, and I can say I don't think we should have this influence over our government, this foreign influence over our government and our media, and still maintain my patriotism. I am no less of an American because I disagree with the course this country is taking right now, and I truly believe in the freedom of speech, even if it offends me. Now, contrast that with the Zionist lobby, who has effectively lobbied in many governments into throwing professors and scholars and other citizens into jail for merely bringing up inconsistencies regarding the Hollywood version of the Holocaust. So, in a question plucked directly from your website, Mr. Weber, how is the Holocaust campaign used to blackmail nations and corporations to enrich already wealthy Jewish organizations?
Well, there's a great deal of documentation about this. You'll find a lot of it on our website, and you'll find it on other places by clicking around. But there's many examples of that, and one of them, of course, is the billions and billions of dollars that have been extorted out of Germany, out of Switzerland, out of France, and other countries as part of this tremendous effort to just squeeze money out of countries for the sins, the oppressions, real or exaggerated, of the past. Now, look, it's understandable in a way that people would want restitution or reparations or so forth for the past. But justice applied selectively is not justice. It's a form of injustice. And when demands are made and huge amounts of money are paid in blackmail for only one set of victims, for only one class, for only one chapter of history, that's not justice. That's injustice.
Extortion.
And a tremendous campaign to squeeze billions of dollars for people who are for one class of victims, while other classes of victims of communism or even of U.S. policy in the past or other countries who don't get anything, of course, that's grossly unfair. You know, I just want to make another point about when a small minority controls the media. I think Americans would be very unhappy. They would be furious if our media was under a similar grip of, say, Scientologists. Or Mormons, or any other group that makes up a small percentage of the population, because inevitably, any group that makes up a small percentage of the population is going to have interests and an outlook that's different from that of the vast majority of people. And why? Just as people would object if Pat Robertson and his supporters were to demand a presentation of the news and of history in accord just with their point of view, so also Americans should be just as indignant when a minority, organized Jewry or Jewish Zionist power, whatever you want to call it, has a similar grip in our society, in fact.
Well, that's very well put, and of course, once again, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and you know, you mentioned Pat Robertson. I happen to be a Christian, and Pat Robertson makes me sick, but, you know, when someone says the Nazis killed 6 million Jews, I don't have a problem with that. That doesn't offend me. If that's what happened, that's fine. But whether you believe or don't believe the alleged atrocities that were said to be committed by the Germans in World War II, should men and women be imprisoned for merely suggesting a dissenting viewpoint? Because that's what's happening in Europe. And if we allow this slippery slope of freedom of speech to be eroded, this might one day affect us all, correct?
Well, we're very fortunate that we live in a country that has freedom of speech as clearly laid out as it is in our Constitution, in our Bill of Rights. It's so clearly laid out that it's very difficult even for the most eager beaver censors or wannabe censors to try to restrict speech here. Now, as you mentioned, in some countries, it's a crime to dispute, even with facts, even factually. That's a point that I'll get into later. But any disputation, any questioning, even questioning of this official view of the Holocaust in a number of European countries is punished with fines, imprisonment, people are forced into exile. Now, the ADL would be, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center, groups like that would be very happy to do that here in our country, but we have a tradition of freedom of speech that's still strong enough that they're going to have to work a lot harder to find a pretext to pull that off here in this country. But having said that, there is still in place, unofficially, such a power of intimidation, as Jimmy Carter points out, especially in our political system, but also in our major newspapers and our major networks, that makes it very difficult to speak openly, not just about the Holocaust issue, which, again, is receding more and more into the past, but notably about the Middle East situation, the Middle East reality. and about other issues as well. You know, the Founding Fathers, when they spoke about freedom of speech, what they had in mind was not what some people call freedom of speech. They didn't have, child pornography is not what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they talked about freedom of speech. But what they certainly had in mind, what they absolutely were determined to try to protect, was scholarly or rational discussion of historical and political current affairs issues. And it's exactly that which is prohibited in Europe. You can say, and the Founding Fathers thought it was all right to even have laws prohibiting blasphemy or laws that were offensive to the religious sensibilities of the American people. That's all been done away with now in America in the name of freedom of speech. But in Europe, you can offend the sensibilities of Christians or of Muslims or other people, but you dare not offend the sensibilities of Jews, and especially with regard to the Holocaust story.
And of course, that's been proven right, and we're talking about not just isolated incidents, but dozens, perhaps even hundreds, of people being jailed and fined and imprisoned for merely asking questions. And you know, if we allow that to occur on one issue, what's to say that it won't also come a time when if you advocate a dissenting viewpoint about third world immigration into your country or whatever issue, pick an issue.
Right.
You know, you could go to jail for that.
Right.
I'm telling you, Mr. Weber, I wish we had had you on for the entire hour. We only have about 2 or 3 minutes left in the program tonight, and you've been an incredibly enlightening guest, and I'm sure our audience has really enjoyed what you've had to say. If there's anything that you would like to cover that we've not yet tackled or broached, have the forum here for a minute.
Well, I would urge people very much to check out the IHR website, IHR.org. As I say, there's much more information there, and it ties it a lot more in with the issues that are really relevant here today. But I want to also take the opportunity to just thank you for having me on the program and for your independent voice in a time when voices like this are more needed than ever in our country.
Well, it's certainly hard to do, and I'm sure you've paid the price as we have, and it's you're under constant attack. But I don't know. There's a sense of pride that passes understanding to be able to do work like this, and it's certainly not monetary. But again, I appreciate you coming on and talking about these sensitive issues, because we need to talk about things like this. And I just want to ask you this in closing. What can Americans do? I mean, we're talking about these problems, and they're big problems. What can Americans do to reclaim America's destiny in their daily lives?
The situation is so bad that I think that first and foremost, people must support groups and organizations which are telling the truth. It's hard to know for many people who to support or what to do in a situation this bad when the whole electoral system seems as rigged as it is and so forth. But the first and foremost is to try, as I've said many times, is to reach especially that minority of people who have both the intelligence, the interest, and the temperament and heart to even care about these issues. That's always a minority in every society.
Well,
the vast majority of people in every country don't really care enough to sacrifice anything about these larger issues. But first and foremost, we try to reach that minority of people who have the wit and the heart and the character to care about the future beyond the lifetime, beyond their own lifetimes, and for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and for generations to come. I mean, obviously, I think it's important to support the work of the IHR, and our work is financed largely by donations. But there are other groups too, and I don't want to make this exclusive, that deserve support as well. But that's first and foremost what people can do, and of course, there's much more in terms of volunteering and so forth to help groups like this, and to alert people, your neighbors, friends, and so forth, to programs like yours and to other people that are doing good things.
Well, I appreciate that. And, of course, apply yourself in the way you feel most led and support the organizations that you feel are the most worthy, because, you know, we lost this thing. We're where we're at today because of think tanks that were fighting against us, and through incrementalism over the last 50 and 60 years, it's been within most people's lifetimes that America took a drastic change from the
1950s. Very well put. Very well put. And it is in this generation. America has changed more in the past 40 years than Eastern Europe did under communist rule during that same period of time.
Our
country has changed more than if we had been conquered and occupied by a foreign nation. In a way, it has been occupation by a foreign power or a foreign nation. And older people understand that, and younger people are confused. They don't know why it's this way, but there's a grave sense of foreboding and of anxiety across the country about the future, because if we project the trends of the past 20 years into the next 20 years,
it looks very bad. Yeah, the game's over. But like I said, if it can be lost within 40 years, perhaps we can work to bring it back. Because what one man can do, another can do. Last question, and we are flat out of time, but I had someone email me this, a regular listener, before we had you on. I'm sure we're going to get a crush of emails after this appearance. We're going to certainly have to have you back. And I have to admit, I'm ignorant about this fella and his work. But one man asked me to ask you this. Does the IIHR have any plans to reprint David Hogan's
interesting you should say that. Yes, that's on our list of books to reprint. There's a number of other books we're working on right now. We just reprinted some items. You'll find some of it, but I'm glad that was brought up. That's a very important book. Copies of Forced War go for, I think, $100 on Amazon.com now, and we need to bring that one back into print, yes.
Well, I'm sure he'll be happy to hear your answer, and we are happy to have you. Mark Weber, everyone, of the IHR. Check him out at IHR.org, and we'll certainly have you back in the future.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.